Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Helen, I don't know where you saw this the other day. I was reading this story about a PhD student. He was studying some LiDAR data quite recently, and he accidentally discovered in this LiDAR data an ancient Maya city in Mexico. I mean, this absolutely incredible find. It got me thinking, what's the most amazing archaeological find that you've made by mistake?
Oh, well, I have made a lot of mistakes in my time, my goodness. Now, when I was doing my PhD, my supervisor sent me off on a trip around Europe to look at museums and to visit universities because I was trying to find parallels or inspirations for the objects that I was studying. At one point, I pitched up in Mainz and I went off to look at the museum there, and I had not done my research properly, and I had no idea that the early medieval room, the galleries, had been closed for refurbishment for some years, it seemed. I got there and I thought, oh, I've come all this way and now I can't see what was going on in this fascinating place. So I trudged off to prehistory thinking, well, at least I can go and have a look around that. That'll be good for me. And that was closed as well that week. And so there was only one thing left to do. And somebody like me that grew up in the Roman city of Bath, I don't like to have to go and look again at the boring old Romans. But that was the only gallery that was open. So I opened the door, walked in, looked at the first case, and there were all my objects kind of looking back at me. The 7th century women that I was studying were effectively dressing up as Romans, and I ended up calling it the First Renaissance. So that gave me the whole thrust of my thesis.
And it all came about by accident. Well, there are no accidents here, because you've just stumbled across another episode of the Time Team podcast.
Yes, welcome to the Time Team podcast. I'm Helen Geek, and that's Martin Williams. Now, I've been looking at that Maya city, you know, Martin, It's got everything we'd expect from a classic Maya city. So it's got masses of housing, and it's got streets and everything you'd expect in a city. It's also got two huge pyramids topped with temples, which are what you usually think of when you think of the classic Maya. And it's also got one of these amazing ball game courts, a bit like a football stadium for us. They're found in all of those Mesoamerican cities. It's not just the Maya that have them, and it seems to have had some kind of ritual importance as well, this ball game, in a way that possibly football also has for us. Right. I don't know. But what I found so extraordinary was that a city that size, with maybe 50,000 people living in it at its peak, it could simply apparently vanish. The vegetation around there is so thick that the leaf drop and the worm action, all those things we were talking about a couple of episodes ago, can really cover up structures like that pretty fast. But what I really like about it is that it's drawing our attention to this thing called the classic Maya collapse. And that's always thought of as being one of the greatest unsolved mysteries in archaeology. It turns our thoughts to why things like this happened, where all the people went. And there have been so many suggestions for the classic Maya collapse, things like invasion and revolution or disease or even having bad leadership. But at the moment, we think it was probably due to climate change. And I think from that, you'll see that those explanations, they really tell us more about our worries as they change over the decades rather than anything else. I hate to say it, that there's no such thing as the truth in archaeology, but it does hold up a kind of mirror to us, what we're interested in. And that's one of the reasons that I find this job so extraordinary.
Right, we need to move on, really, because it's a busy old podcast this episode, as it always is. Coming up a little later, you'll meet one of the people responsible for the incredible graphic reconstructions that you see on the show. Giselle Kirai, who you might have seen fronting episodes of Time Team on excavations of the Band of Brothers site, which was really popular. She's going to be telling you a little bit more about her life as a commercial archaeologist. And plus, of course, there's your questions as well via Patreon.
If you think about it, there are so many tools that an archaeologist might use to do their job. We've always had traditional earthwork survey and aerial photographs, but they've now been joined by geophysics and LIDAR. And then when digging, you can go from the mechanical digger, as we saw with John a few episodes ago, down to something like a shovel, which I feel is a much underrated tool. And then you've got the multi-purpose trowel. Now, that does everything from making a surface to finding an edge to even cleaning your boots. Not to mention pencils and permatrays for drawing and, of course, cameras for taking photographs. Now, some of those tools might require more skill and experience than others. And the one that requires a great deal of skill and particularly experience is a metal detector. And at every Time Team excavation, we have people walking across the site, headphones on, detector in hand. But what are they looking for and how difficult is it to find it? And Martin's been finding out.
I'm Keith Westcott, and since the Cornwall dig, I've done all of the Time Team digs now as far as the metal detecting perspective is concerned. This is an instrument which gives us so much information by way of dating evidence that we can work with the geophysics and before you do any sort of digging into the ground as such with excavation, we can actually plot out the spatial positions of our finds with the geophysics and from that learn a lot to be able to define the site. The first thing we do is we look at the type of ground and the area and decide what program we're going to use. We set the actual detector up to try and find those small finds, because quite often we're talking about very, very small little finds which might be sat in between nails or whatever, and we're trying to distinguish the very small ones between that.
And the actual act then is what, sweeping across? That's what I'm imagining, a sort of sweeping action as you walk around very slowly.
Yes, you've got to keep it nice and slow and keep the head of the metal detector really as close to the floor as possible. It's a nice slow sweep and making your way forward at a slow pace. When we get here, we can actually start to look for dating evidence, and we actually field walk at the same time as metal detect. So we're not just looking for metal finds, we're looking for all material finds.
And what's the most amazing thing you've ever found?
Not too far from where we're stood, I found a hoard of silver coins. Later, the British Numismatic Society wrote a long piece saying that actually the coins I found shouldn't have been there at the time of the siege of this castle, which was straight after the Battle of Edge Hill in 1642. They said actually they came into the country later because they believed these were the coins of Queen Henrietta Maria, Queen to Charles I.
Wow, so you found something not just sort of amazing just because you found a hoard of silver coins, which is great in itself, but that had real historical importance and significance.
Well, it's the uniqueness of this. I'm not interested in treasure. I'm only looking at historical significance. It's much more about that wider information that I can bring and really contribute to sort of heritage conservation and our understanding of the past.
Well, can you show me how it works?
Okay, so I'm just turning on the machine at the moment. Let's just make our way across and along this grassed area.
So that's making a bit of a noise now then. So what could that that little beep signify?
It's a slightly broken signal, and it's also quite low on the readout here. So that tells me it's quite likely going to be a ferrous material. So that higher one,
it's like it's talking to you.
It is talking, because actually we've got this low signal here, mm-hmm. which on the graft is low, but at the same time the sound is very low and broken. But you're just moving to the side only by 50-60 millimetres or so, you're getting a much higher pitch, a much cleaner pitch, and the graph is showing much higher as well. So that's what you're trying to do in reading the ground. You're listening for those different tones, and that gives you an idea of what to dig.
Keith Westcott and his metal detector. Well, Martin, I can hear your love of radio, of audio from that. All those lovingly recorded beeps, I've never quite heard them. So nicely done. Of course, most of the time, metal detectorists are wearing headphones and you don't hear anything. But that gave us a window into what they're experiencing.
Yeah, I quite like the idea, because I've seen them walking around Time Team dig sites, and I do quite like the idea, because they seem quite sort of in their own world and isolated, and that is because they've got the headphones on and they are listening to those beeps as they go across the earth and the landscape. What are they going to uncover when they get a signal? And Helen, as an archaeologist, how important are the metal detectorists when you're on site to the work that you're doing?
Well, it depends what you mean by on-site, because metal detectorists do two things. First of all, they look at the topsoil, and a lot of the time this is plough soil, where archaeology is coming into the plough soil and being disturbed by the plough, churned around, and we lose the context, we lose the relationships of soil, but the objects stay there and can be found. So that's one thing, and that's my day job. I record objects that are found by metal detectorists across large landscapes. But on sites, on excavations, as Keith said, they give us fantastic dating evidence. And what we don't want to do is get that fantastic dating evidence off the spoil heap, where it can't actually tell us what it is dating, because we don't anymore know where it came from. So what we like to do with metal detectorists on site is not only to monitor the spoil heap, but also to look at the surfaces of features within the trenches to give us a kind of sneak preview into what might be there. That sometimes causes a bit of tension, because we often expect them to work miracles. We want them to predict exactly what will be found, exactly how deep. Come on, Keith, tell us where it is and what it is. And he's always having to say, well, I can't quite tell you that. And also, chasing a signal can often take a lot more time than simply quickly digging a section through a feature. So they are incredibly useful. But as with any remote sensing technique, anything like geophysics or anything like that, you can only really find out the truth by excavating it, by digging it, by ground truthing it. But I wouldn't like to be without a metal detector on site, no.
This is the Time Team podcast, where there is so much to learn about archaeology through catching up with members of the team. And let's bring on Giselle Kirai. You might recognise her if you've watched any of the episodes about Band of Brothers. And in fact, there's recently been a few catch-up episodes on that Operation Nightingale dig, which you can see on YouTube. And the team there, which also includes, by the way, serving and former military personnel, excavated a site in the UK where the American 101st Airborne Division, those guys otherwise known as the Band of Brothers, trained before parachuting behind enemy lines in the days leading up to D-Day in the Second World War. It is all there on YouTube for you to watch. And Giselle's been working quite a bit on that and a number of other things that you might find interesting.
Yes, and that's because you're a commercial archaeologist, aren't you, Giselle? So you must have a huge variety of projects in your life. Could you tell us a bit about a typical day, if there is such a thing?
Gosh, I don't really know if there is a typical day, but normally you just wake up in the morning, pop over to a site that could be on a nice tarmac road, it could be on a nice pothole filled road, and then you get to site and you start your daily task, whether that's digging a pit, a post hole, a ditch, whatever it might be, drawing some sections and trying to build a picture of what that site is that you're on.
So is that a site that has to have its archaeology investigated because it's going to be developed or in some other way damaged?
Yes. So we always go in as commercial archaeologists before roads are built, before quarries are quarried, before houses are built. And so we want to check the archaeology and we want to record it and make sure that we have that history forever. Because once that archaeology gets destroyed, we'll never get it again. So it's almost, we're the last people to see it before it gets destroyed forever. So we have to do a really good job.
If, say, the road builder is paying you to find archaeology, they don't really want you to find it, do they? Because it would make their life an awful lot more expensive. So how do we know
Have another tenner if you don't find that pot.
Exactly. So how come the whole system works?
I think that in England specifically, that's the only place I've really done most of my commercial archaeology work. England has such a pride for its history. And so I think everybody, even construction workers, even if there's a bit of an annoyance that we have to go in and we have to do this work, they do care that that history is being recorded.
I suppose what I'm trying to get at is that we don't have state funding, but what we do have is an element of state control. So our archaeology belongs to everybody, really, doesn't it? I mean, not just in Britain, but all around the world.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so we have to have a way of making sure that people can't just bulldoze it away. And that's mainly through the planning system, isn't it?
Planning permission is so important because basically somebody has to ask if it's possible for someone to come and look at the archaeology and record that history. And so we've got a whole team of people from geophysicists who will look at the ground first and do some radar, check the ground, see if it's important enough to be looked at. And then through a series of permissions, you end up getting archaeologists looking at it. And so it's thanks to that type of funding that we're able to record the history. And that's really important.
Now, Giselle, you first came to my attention through those Time Team episodes on Band of Brothers. And that, I guess, is a really good lesson in how archaeology isn't just about Romans, Saxons and bits of pottery, is it? I mean, archaeology can be from as recently as, well, yesterday.
It's really interesting because I think in the country, a lot of people think that we only do academic digs or we only do commercial digs, or maybe they don't know that one or the other exists. And so actually the Band of Brothers site is a community dig, or you can think of it as more of an academic dig. So it's for the purpose of retaining the information of that site, but it's for the community as well. And to get a good idea of the history of that specific area, there's not going to be building in that location. It's on a football pitch. So it's not going to be built upon, but it's another way that we can record the history of the country.
And the work on that site and the things that you discovered there still goes on because you've recently been trying to work out something about one of the dog tags that you found on the dig and how it could have been folded. Just explain the confusion there or the mystery that you've been trying to solve.
Sure. Yeah, we've actually had 3 dog tags over the years. We've been at that site for, gosh, I don't know, maybe 5 years or so now. And so the first time we found a dog tag, actually we found 2 in a year, which was absolutely unheard of. I can't even believe still that we found that. But we found one that was perfectly flat. And the next one we found was slightly bent. And that already got our minds working. What could the bent dog tag mean? We weren't sure. We thought maybe it was something that you would toss away. But tossing away a dog tag is a massive offense. You don't want to be doing that. So then this past year, we found one that was completely folded up, like a trifold. That was definitely deliberate. We got to learn more about the guy himself. We looked into the tags. Were they reissued at some point, which they were. So we think he got rid of that with purpose. And just trying to understand a bit more about not just the site and not just the finds, but the people who held the finds and create that connection to humanity, which is so important in archaeology.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because a dog tag kind of holds your identity. And so you wouldn't chuck it away because just like we wouldn't chuck away a credit card or something or a driving license. But if you've got a new one, then it's very suddenly very important that the old one is destroyed. You see the same kind of thing with medieval seal matrices. The thing that made the mark in the wax seal that authenticated your document, if you decide to get a new one, then you've got the problem of getting rid of the old one because a fraud happens just as much today as in the Second World War as in the medieval period. So sometimes we come across them cut up or folded in half, and that suddenly you've got an extra little bit of knowledge about how life was going for that person, or at least a bit of imagination about how life was going for that person. It's a bit of a moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really cool. And this one specifically, the reason of the reissue was because the original dog tag that we found folded up, It had extra family information. So it had the address of the next of kin and things like that. And the American side of the war was a bit nervous that maybe that would be used against Americans and maybe the wrong side would come across these addresses. And so it wasn't just folding it up to get rid of it for the new tag. It was folding it up and ensuring that your family member potentially was safe if that was a concern for you. And we actually found it not just folded up on the ground. It was, we think, shoved through some floorboards as well. It was right underneath the bottom of a hut, a Nissen hut. So that's quite a cool story. If you start to think of the whole thing and the whole picture together, it really paints a picture of this guy's life and those moments that he had to just quickly toss it away.
Yes, and of course, something that we often forget is he didn't know who was going to win the war.
That's so true.
So that, there might have been more of an idea of getting rid of evidence if you were in a foreign country and you didn't know who was going to win, or you couldn't be absolutely sure. Yeah, it's amazing. It's such an interesting site, that, isn't it? And the whole concept of Second World War archaeology is becoming so much more important as it fades from living memory.
Yeah, and I find that amazing because my grandma was in the war. And I think if I was to tell her that Time Team is doing archaeology on a period when she was alive, I think she'd probably look at me and scratch her head and say, what on earth are you doing? But it makes so much sense, doesn't it? And there is so much more that we can learn through doing archaeology, even in recent history. Now, Giselle, before you go, I really want to talk to you about human remains.
Sure.
If that's okay. I'm not planning anything. I just know that it's another part of your job. Obviously, all archaeologists come across burials every now and again, but you've got quite a bit of experience working on large cemeteries, analysing bones. And I wonder, where do you start when you, I suppose, come across a skeleton, for example?
Well, normally on a commercial site, we might have an idea that there are graves because we've done geophysics and we've been able to look at the shapes of in the ground and see that there are, you know, series of grave-shaped pits. But there's sometimes when you have no evidence, like during the Iron Age, we end up coming across it by accident. Usually someone's just digging a pit and then, oops, there's a bit of bone. So they slowly start to go through it and they slowly whittle away all of the soil around the bones. We end up taking photos of it, kind of doing a photogrammetry sometimes to get a very nice picture of the whole body. And then we'll draw it as well. Those bones will be taken back to a lab or back to the unit's home base, and then they get cleaned and then they get sent to a human osteologist. So I do that for our company, and then I'll analyze it, try and figure out the sex, the age, any diseases, look at the dentition and create a picture of who that person was and how they fit into the wider community as well. So it's a really very cool job from start to finish. If you're the field archaeologist digging it, it's really fascinating, and you create a special bond with every skeleton you dig.
Yeah, it's a very intimate thing, isn't it? Being up so close to another human being, even though they might have lived centuries ago, you do get to know them in an odd way, don't you?
Absolutely. It's a unique experience.
Well, Giselle, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should mention, by the way, that as well as the episodes on Band of Brothers that are on YouTube, there's some bonus material on that subject up on Patreon at the moment, and it includes a chat with the family of the man whose dog tag was found or folded up at the site that Giselle was telling us. And Giselle is a big part of that conversation, as is Richard Osgood from Operation Nightingale. So if you are interested in that, then head over to Patreon.
Yes, Patreon is your one-stop shop for extra content from Time Team. Not only can you use it to interact with this podcast, there's exclusive content like that Band of Brothers video, behind-the-scenes access, and, of course, the knowledge that you're contributing to the funding of some really important archaeology, both here in the UK and around the world. And right now, we're gearing up for a special Black Friday offer on membership. Plus, you'll soon be able to give Patreon membership as a present to someone in your life who's crazy about archaeology and history.
That's a good idea, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And all the details are online. You need to go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Now, I've just been inducted, Helen, into the Time Team WhatsApp chat.
Oh, my goodness. You'll never have any time to do anything else in your life. And it's absolutely full of nonsense.
Well, there is a lot of nonsense, I have to say, but I'm enjoying the nonsense. What I've noticed, actually, is that there are certain people who are completely obsessed with creating those AI songs, you know, where they tell the AI a load of ideas and then it creates a full song of, you know, whatever it is that you put in. And a few days ago, one of the members of the WhatsApp chat got a special song in his honour, and it's because it was his birthday.
Oh, now you must be talking about Bear.
I am.
Because it was his birthday the other day, absolutely. And he's part of the team who create those amazing 3D graphics. And I love them because not only do they really bring a site to life, but the process of doing it is really useful for archaeology as well, because it makes us really think about what our discoveries mean kind of in real life, if you see what I mean. We have to answer Bear's questions, which are always really good.
Yeah. And when we were at Norton Disney a few weeks ago, I actually dropped in on Bear at the Data Dome, where he was working away at his computer to find out how it all works.
We pull all the information from all the different disciplines. So we work on the graphics months after the site. We try and do as much as we can during a dig, because we want a kind of live feel of what the site would have looked like and what the information coming from the trenches and the experts is telling us. But we also have to wait for the science, so the flotation or chemical analysis of different finds, XRF results, all these information come together and we interpret from all the different experts, from landscape, from geophysics. We just collate all this information and creatively put together what a site should look like. And that's partly dictated by the storyline that the directors want and what we want to reveal about the site, what we think the best interpretation for the viewer to make a understandable visual of what's been discovered.
You've sort of alluded to it already, but why is it so important to be here whilst the dig's taking place? Because this is stuff that you'd think that you'd be able to do just sort of any old time sitting in an office somewhere.
We are capturing material as it's coming out of the ground for the patrons to look at as photogrammetry, and we're then doing cleaned up versions when they've been conserved and analysed, so we've got the comparison of the two. We will also collect all the information that we can from existing buildings, but we also capture material that we'll use for the reconstruction by studying nearby contemporary buildings. We'll get wall textures, floor textures. We will talk to people also about the environment, the local landscape, how it's changed. So for this site, where the waters of the fens used to flow around the village, where the high grounds were, where people used to live. So if we try and make a large reconstruction, we want the background world beyond the site to feel correct, so the setting is correct as well as the history we're trying to depict.
And how do you get it so lifelike? Because the graphics are great.
We try and put as much as we can in, so whether anyone spots the ants, the bugs, the bees, the butterflies. You might start with the butterflies. I've got obsessed with making large butterflies. We try and put the correct plants and herbs into gardens, into some of the monastic sites we've done. We try and put the right trees for crops and corn and all sorts of bits and pieces in, based on, again, the information we're given from historians and talking through with all the different departments. And so during a dig, we are going around constantly grilling people for information, making notes, taking photos, talking to local experts who are visiting the site. It all contributes for making a large model. Now, whether we'll get every single thing in the reconstruction is going to come down to time and what we need for the actual episode, and that will come through the director saying what they want to depict. It's important to give people a visual that helps them interpret what they've learned from the archaeologists and from the experts, because there are so many different disciplines that come together to tell us what was here or what was on a site and what has been lost to time. And I have the pleasure of making that the visual rather than someone trying to depict it in their own mind's eye. We get to put those images in their minds, show them what we think it should be.
And what do you get out of this? Why do you enjoy working on Time Team and doing the 3D graphics for it?
Apart from being a long-term fan, I love telling a story visually. recreating the past that's lost based on everything that we can learn from a site, whether it be on site during a dig or in the months of analysis and study that come after. I don't think people realise how much work goes on from everybody after a dig finishes. Yes, we're on site for 3 days, but people will still be going to bed at 3 a.m. in March, and here we are, September, October, but people have been researching for this dig for months and years, in some cases, before we even start filming. So, yeah, it's a long period of work.
That's Bear, our graphics whiz, talking about his passion for storytelling and using art and computer graphics to do that. And you know, Martin, you can always tell Bear's work because it tends to have butterflies flitting about. Or sometimes, if that's completely inappropriate, he adds seagulls or bats or something. He loves to have something flying around to kind of liven up the scene. And it's his trademark. It's really lovely.
And they're so good, aren't they, those graphics, for, as you were saying earlier, telling that story and allowing you to immerse yourself. Because very often, you know, you see all this stuff in the ground and you see these trenches and you're like, okay, well, I understand that a thing was there, a building was there, or, you know, whatever it might have been. But to actually be able to see where that was in context, what it maybe would have looked like in real life, just gives you a window on that bit of history that you would never get otherwise.
Yeah, you're totally right. You can understand it with one part of your brain, but you can only feel it really when you see it. And that's what makes it so important.
So well done, Bear, and happy birthday, we should say, as well.
Absolutely,
I think it was
a week or so ago now,
but happy birthday.
We're not going to sing.
No. And we're not going to sing that dreadful AI song either, no, my word. No. It was quite something. Right, let's move on to questions. Thank you, by the way, if you've submitted questions on Patreon. We still want loads. I want to keep them coming in because they are so wonderful and they get us thinking, particularly Helen, because she has to answer them. And it's so easy to do. You go on Patreon, there'll be a post right now about this episode, and you can just comment on that post with your question for Helen. Please do that, because we want as many as we possibly can for the next episode. This comes in from Chris, and this is something that I've been thinking about actually over the last few days. Chris says, I followed your live streams for Sutton Hoo, and of course last episode we were talking a lot about Sutton Hoo. As an American, maybe I'm not understanding it, but what is the significance of Sutton Hoo? Would it be possible to talk about the history of the place for those who can't make it to the sites? And maybe you can do it in the next podcast. Well, we are, Chris, doing it in this podcast. And I wonder, Helen, whether we need to go completely back to basics here and explain why it is that Sutton Hoo is just so famous. And I think I can maybe sum it up in with two things, what I think of when I think of Sutton Hoo. And number one is obviously the burial mounds. And number two is the buried ship.
Yes, well done. Well, I'll give you a bit of a correction straight away, Martin. It's buried ships, plural.
Oh,
because Sutton Hoo is often thought of as being the great ship burial, but that's just one of the mounds. There's probably around 18 mounds at Sutton Hoo. We can't be completely sure. The whole site hasn't been excavated. And certainly two of them we've discovered ship burials in. Now, it's really, really rare to have an intact, rich Anglo-Saxon grave. It's almost as rare as finding an intact Egyptian royal grave. And so this was what first brought Sutton Hoo to international attention. In 1939, the landowner, Mrs. Pretty, commissioned an archaeologist, Basil Brown, to find out what her mounds were. This kind of exploded onto the archaeological scene just before the Second World War broke out. So it couldn't be analysed and really understood for decades afterwards. So it's always been in our public consciousness since then as being the richest grave ever excavated in Britain. That's one story, but the real importance of Sutton Hoo is the number of stories that it has to tell, because it dates to the early 7th century AD. That's its time of most activity at Sutton Hoo. And that is the point at which kingdoms are beginning to crystallise out of the chaos of the Dark Ages. And Sutton Hoo gives us a kind of floodlight into the Dark Ages. But it's not just that. I think one of the reasons that it's become so iconic in Britain is because we are completely obsessed on this island with royalty. And this is where we can first see royalty beginning to show itself. We're also obsessed with us being an island, and we have here a ship. So it kind of sums up England and maybe Britain in a way that I don't think any other site does. And just, I mean, I could talk forever on this, but just the last thing I'll say is the landowner, Mrs. Pretty, and obviously she was a woman. She was making a lot of the decisions. She commissioned the original excavation and so on. And when it got to a treasure inquest, because it fell under the law of treasure trove, it was decided that it didn't qualify as treasure trove. And the headline in the Daily Mail after the verdict of the inquest was, "Saxon treasure goes to woman." So it seems extraordinary. But she was a widow. She was running her own affairs, and she decided that she was going to give it to the British Museum. So she's been one of the major, major benefactors of the British Museum. And that's another story in its own right that's told in the film The Dig that came out a few years ago. But from my point of view, because the burial of the ship and the wider burials in the Mound Cemetery, it got so many resources, so much poured into creating that cemetery in the late 6th to late 7th centuries AD. Because so much investment was put into it then, there's so much data, there's so much information there, there's so much that we can learn about it. The more you put into something, the more you get out of it. And that's as true for Anglo-Saxon cemeteries as it is for anything else in life.
Chris, I would say, and Helen's already mentioned it, but if you haven't seen The Dig on Netflix and you want to know just the kind of overview really of Sutton Hoo to understand a little bit more about its context and maybe a little bit about the story of its discovery in the late 30s, then maybe do go and watch it. It's called The Dig on Netflix. I would recommend it, and it's got quite a soppy love story attached to it as well, but it also has some quite interesting bits of historical interest as well. Thank you very much for that question. One more, and it comes from Kate Millen, who says, "Hello, I was wondering what happens on sites once the filming stops. Can you let us know?" Oh, we couldn't possibly tell you, Kate. No, I think we could. I mean, it's everything. Nobody gets too drunk.
Well, I was looking at Kate's question and I thought, well, I could talk a lot about backfilling strategies and how we might repair people's gardens that we've messed up and post excavation.
Yeah, we don't want to know about that.
Yeah, somehow I don't think you're asking about that, Kate, are you? You're asking about, let me see. Sites that are quite close to home for a lot of us, people do tend to go home that night because you want to be back in your own bed, you want to rest after 3 days. It's the sites that are a long way from home that are the more interesting, because a lot of us then stay the night so we can drive back in the morning. And of course, there isn't too much to do in the morning, so we know we can stay up late. And one of my best memories of a recent one was, you remember when we went to Broughton Roman Villa and we didn't have time to excavate the stone coffin there, so we sent out a little expedition crew for 2 days over a very hot weekend to excavate the stone coffin. And most of the people on that expedition crew turned out to be people who liked to play the guitar. And on Time Team, we all like to sing. So the last night, we were staying in a variety of hotels, but Tim Taylor had a hotel with a suite, with a sitting room in it, and he invited us all up to his sitting room, where we had about 4 guitars, and some of us sing in choirs. Me and Emily, the director, we sing in choirs, and a lot of other people are good folk singers and so on. That's what we often do, we sing. We still haven't quite worked out how to do this well, because the guitar players know what they're doing and the singers often get the words on their phones. But because, I mean, particularly for Emily and me with our choir background, we're used to knowing how many bars there are before we come in, and the guitar people think we ought to know that,
right.
So there's always a lot of kind of befuddled looks. Are we supposed to come in there? How many times are we doing the chorus? But it doesn't perhaps sound good, but we love doing it.
Oh, that sounds fun.
And every time I listen to Van Morrison's Brown Eyed Girl, that's Tim Taylor's party piece, So that we usually end with a loud chorus of Brown-Eyed Girl.
Oh my word. I'm yet to see this, but I am very excited to experience it at some point in the future. You can think on that then, Kate. As you imagine, when a Time Team Dig ends, we're all singing Brown-Eyed Girl. Now you know. Right, that is about all we have time for on this episode of the Time Team Podcast. Thank you so much for taking just a few minutes out of your day, and we hope you enjoyed it.
And next week, you'll hear the final part of Martin's conversation with Time Team's creator, Tim Taylor.
He'll of Brown-Eyed Girl fame.
Oh, yes, yes. So he can play more than just Brown-Eyed Girl, but that's the one he really likes. So Tim's going to be looking to the future, what the show has become, how it'll continue to grow online, all that kind of thing. Plus, we'll have much more from the world of archaeological discovery. We'll speak to you next time on the Time Team Podcast. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.